From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is a special pledge drive episode of Reveal. I'm Al Edson. When it comes to inequity in American life, here's a startling statistic. For decades, Black babies in the United States have been twice as likely to die before their first birthday compared to white babies. Most of the babies die because they're born premature, and with the complications, they don't make it. That statistic has touched me personally. A little over 20 years ago, my daughter Lauren died in utero about a month before her due date. The pain of that loss never really goes away. You just learn how to live with it better. Back in 1984, there was a congressional hearing focused on the failure to close the gap. One of the speakers was an obstetrician named Dr. Vicki Alexander. In her testimony, she called the situation genocide through neglect perpetuated by the U.S. government.
I stand at the bedside of these mothers, some white, some Latina, but mostly Black, at the bedside of these mothers whose babies are dying. And when I know it can be prevented, I don't want to hear about task forces.
This is Vicki reading a transcript of the testimony all these decades later. She's 79 now.
It's like I could say the same thing again right now. The ratio is still 2-1.
Almost 40 years later, there's a lot that's changed. The infant mortality rate in the U.S. is lower. More babies make it beyond that first year, but the gap is still there. Black babies are still twice as likely to die as white babies, and this is regardless of income or education level of the mother.
It has to do with economy, with housing, with jobs, the social determinants of one's health, as well as the toxic stress of living in a racist society.
Vicki has continued to fight for these issues. Along with testifying and organizing, she founded a San Francisco Bay Area nonprofit called Healthy Black Families. And along the way, she's mentored other doctors with the same mission.
So, hi, my name is Zaya Malawa. I'm a mother and one of the few people who is Black and born in San Francisco and still lives in San Francisco.
Zaya practiced as a pediatrician for 11 years before she decided to go back to school and get a degree in public health.
When I was getting my master's of public health at Berkeley, people would always approach me and they would ask me, so what are you going to do when you graduate? And I was like, what I would like to be is an activist physician. So do you know anyone who can help me figure out what job that is? And multiple people introduced me to Dr. Vicki as a prime example of what it means to have a career as an activist physician.
Zaya now runs a program called Expecting Justice, focused on improving maternal and infant health in San Francisco's most marginalized communities. These two activist physicians have dedicated their lives to this work. So we invited them into our studio to interview each other.
So Dr. Alexander, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about, you know, you have so many decades of incredible work behind you. Like, tell us how you took a traditional physician job and made it an activist physician job.
I don't remember a time when I did not want to be a doctor. I went to UC San Francisco. At the time I finished medical school, I really knew I wanted to do women's health. This was the time of the Panthers. There were movements all over the place. And I couldn't do all of that, although I wanted to. But I had to study and I had to do my residency. In the process of doing my residency, it became clear to me the statistics around birthing for Black people. And then I became real angry. And so I became the spokesperson for something called the Coalition to Fight Infant Mortality. That type of activity really helped me to politicize myself and feel good about myself. Whereas prior, I was feeling really like, oh, God, this is hard. Oh, God, maybe I'm stupid, you know. But this helped me to find my niche, an activist doctor. How did you get started?
When I was little, I had really bad asthma. I was born in the 70s, and so the asthma medicines that we have now were not there then. My mom was in her early 20s when she had me, and she's a single mother. And so we were this black family that would come in once a month with a kid with very severe asthma. We would frequently leave the hospital against medical advice because of how abusive and abrasive sometimes the medical staff would be in treating us. And on one of these particularly hard ER visits, at a certain point when these residents were literally fighting with my mom because I couldn't swallow this pill, this doctor came into the room. He threw everybody out. He took this pill and he opened it into some applesauce and he said, "We are going to have a tea and applesauce party." And I remember in that moment when I was 5 or 6 thinking, like, every black kid should be able to have this kind of hospital experience, so this is probably my work. I think another really critical piece of this, though, was that my mom grew up with some of the most intense childhood trauma that I know. And despite that, by the time she had me when she was 24, she had us on, like, a full vegetable, organic, healthy diet. And I asked her, I was like, how did you get there? And she told me that the Panthers reached her when she was in her late teens in San Francisco. And so by the time she had me, she was really clear that she was going to raise me healthy. She was going to invest in my education, but she was also going to raise me with a sense of accountability to my community. Something that strikes me a lot, Dr. Vicky, is that even though we've been able to reduce infant mortality rates for people of all racial backgrounds, the disparity between races persists completely untouched. As far back as 1984, you were in front of Congress testifying about this.
All right, good. Like, so here's a paragraph. I'll leave you with the question. How long is it going to take to change this? Why should black babies die twice as frequently as white babies? How many bedsides am I going to have to sit at constantly over and over? And how many times are we going to have to take time away from that patient and come in here to Washington, D.C. to say it over and over again? Thank you. And that was my last statement.
But it's a valid question.
And I was really pissed.
Because how many times are we going to have to say it? And what do you think it will take to start to change things?
Are you asking that as a rhetorical question, Sam?
I'm asking that as an authentic question. I mean, of course I have ideas. You know me.
And why is it not changing? It's not changing because the housing situations continue. The education system continues in a biased way, despite all these nice little programs we got. And, you know, just those social things. And those things have not been addressed in concert with the medical stuff. It's almost like a separation.
You know, I'm in my 40s, and I hear this testimony, and all of it is totally applicable right now. And it hurts my heart a lot, honestly, because I know how hard folks have been working. But that being said, there are a lot of things that are happening that also give me a lot of hope. There's such an incredible coalition right now across the country of incredible black leaders who care about this work. We have powerful legislators like Senator Kamala Harris on our side in this struggle. But I also feel very moved by non-black leaders who are showing up in solidarity because that's the only way we move forward. And so in the name of racial solidarity, I want to name that it is not just black women who are experiencing birth disparities, but also a lot of indigenous communities, including Native American and Pacific Islander communities. And so I feel this synergy of people who recognize that enough is enough. It's time for us to do the deeper work of really addressing the consequences of racism. And the fact that people recognize this, it just gives me hope. I feel magic in the air. I feel like in the next 5 years, we're going to see something different. I truly believe that.
Wow, Zaya, it's wonderful to have you up and coming. This is precisely what's necessary. Congratulations.
Thank you. I mean, come along. Don't act like this is not your work, too.
Yeah, right.
you can't escape
it. It's all of our work.
You can't escape it.
It's all of our work.
You know, Vicky, neither of us are new to our careers anymore. And this work, it takes a personal toll. What keeps you in the game, Vicky?
I think underlying it all is healthy families, healthy babies. Just seeing them keeps me motivated. My own child, I adopted a child. I waited too long and then couldn't get pregnant, so I adopted. And my grandchildren. On the other hand, I am in therapy.
That's real.
I do meet times of real depression. I guess I'm just like any other person. How about you? How are you going to deal with the next 40 years?
You know, I can't help but see possibility everywhere I look. In these beautiful communities that I do work in, if I'm seeing all of these incredible possibilities, it's impossible to step away. Although it's exhausting. And I hope that I get to a place where I'm like, I don't see any other things that need work.
Oh, wow.
I hope I get there.
That's activist physician Zaya Malawa and Vicky Alexander. We recorded this interview before the pandemic hit, but their sense of outrage and optimism is still intact. The story was produced by Priska Neely. We will continue to report on the inequities faced by people of color in the U.S., and we hope that you'll continue to listen. You know, at the end of every Reveal episode, I say there is always more to the story. Well, part of that is you, the role you play in keeping independent journalism going. Here's how to do that.